This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
Well, John McCain is worried about gay sweaters. I guess, you know, this is the Republican mantra. Blame it on the gays. I welcome, by the way, greetings to the program. My friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. John McCain is reportedly, this over at thinkprogress.org, is reportedly complaining about his aides forcing him to wear gay sweaters. That's an actual quote. In order to look younger. In order to, according to one insider, the nitpicking, K-N-I-T, picking, this is from Radar Online, was the crescendo of a tirade by the Arizona senator in which he blistered aides about the minutiae of the campaign. McCain reportedly declared his frustration with being told to don the perceived homosexual outerwear in order to look younger and more approachable. Jeez. At least just, you know, call it metrosexual or something. I mean, that's really what I think they were trying to do, was, you know, just make him look a little more hip or something. Anyhow, Olympia Snow is going to co-sponsor, officially co-sponsor, the bill to withdraw from Iraq. This is a big deal. The Republican senator from Maine has officially signed on as a co-sponsor to legislation to pull our troops out of Iraq as of April 30th, 2008. And, I mean, there, so far, now we have two. Gordon Smith of Oregon, who is running for his life, and we're going to be talking about Senator Smith in the next hour at some length, and Olympia Snow, two Republicans who are going to vote with the Democrats on this. And I suppose at one level, we should say, hey, you know, good on you for doing it. On another level, you know, why have you been voting with Bush all these last 5 years, all the way up to this point? It's a tough one to figure out. In the meantime, the Competitive Enterprise Institute has a new report out. I find this fascinating. CEI on point. CEI.org is their website, Competitive Enterprise Institute. Conservative think tank, Washington, D.C. on Connecticut Street. It's called The Flexibility Solution, How Private Enterprise Can Improve Infrastructure Security. Eli Lehrer is with us. He's a senior fellow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute and author of this report, The Flexibility Solution. Eli, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. You say in your report, I have a copy of the report here, you say countries create government. Well, actually, before I get to that, the main essence of your report is essentially that you say when government wants to change that. Well, let me actually go to the beginning of the beginning. You're saying that the security of our country is better handled by private corporations than by we the people through our government. Do I have the essence of it correctly?
Not entirely. That's certainly one of our points, that the private sector in many cases can do better. Now, on a number of important security issues, the government does have to take the lead. Private government cannot fight war.
It is right now. You have between 100 and 140,000 private contractors in Iraq right now.
But they're not.
And 40,000-50,000 of them are armed.
Yes, they are. They're not frontline combat troops.
How do you know?
Those are things the private sector can't do.
But how do you know? I mean, there have been a number of situations where Blackwater has been involved in for example, the massacre in Fallujah was triggered because four Blackwater guys went through there, you know, armed. And in fact, the families are suing Blackwater, suggesting that they weren't appropriately armed, shorten it. But
that, I'm not familiar with the details of that situation in particular, but certainly there are places that people, the private sector can play a role in it. The private sector shouldn't, for example, declare war, though. I mean, that's properly a governmental responsibility. But there are a lot of places where the private sector can and should play a bigger role.
So, and your rationale for this is, you say when government wants to change or extend what it does, it needs political approval. Private enterprise does not need political approval. And you see that as a reason for private enterprise being involved in security, like policing and, you know, protecting our critical infrastructure here in the United States. I would say that's just what I'm afraid of. What I'm afraid of is the fact that private enterprise doesn't need the approval of we the people.
Well, I think you're misconstruing my point a tiny bit.
I'm quoting you. Verbatim. You say governments cannot respond to ever-changing threats from
infrastructure security, not policing, though. I've spent a lot of time studying policing, and I firmly believe that's a government responsibility.
But you talk about airline security, electric grid security, telecommunications infrastructure.
That's infrastructure security. That's
right.
Not,
these are
that's
people walking
policing.
Around inside the United States with guns. And you want them working for private corporations, answerable to private corporations, and you say that the reason why these guys who are walking around inside the United States with guns, that they can point at you and pull the trigger, is because when government wants to change or extend what it does, it needs political approval, private enterprise does not, and that's a good thing.
You're really misconstruing what our paper is about. Our paper is about the fact that private enterprise is more flexible, and flexibility has a number of advantages for infrastructure security. We firmly believe that. This has very little to do with things that are properly core government powers.
Why would private enterprise be any more or less flexible than government? I did consulting work for years and years, and I've consulted with government agencies as well as major corporations. And I'll tell you, I've worked with several Fortune 500 corporations that were far more clunky and difficult to get anything done in than even major government agencies like the U.S. military intelligence or the NSA.
I agree with you, actually. If you look at any given private corporation, it may or may not be more flexible than the government. I work for a corporation that I can say my next job was with the government, and I can say for certain that the government, the piece of the government that I worked for, Congress, was much more flexible than that corporation. So, yes, a given company, sure. But
you just knocked down your own argument here, Eli. We're talking with Eli Lehrer, by the way, of Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org.
Yeah, and by the way, we're a libertarian think tank. You referred to us as a conservative think tank, but anyway.
Okay, thank you. Which brings us to the essence of this issue.
You're misconstruing what my paper says, though.
Well, let me quote your paper, then. Limits to government's role. You say countries create governments mainly to protect society against threats, foreign and domestic.
Yes.
I would challenge that.
Continue to do that. The paper is about infrastructure security, not policing. It's about securing infrastructure. And in many cases, the private sector can do a better job securing infrastructure because it will take multiple approaches while government tends towards one-size-fits-all. Approaches, and I'm talking primarily about infrastructure that's privately owned in the first place. I think that to a large extent, corporations that own infrastructure should not rely on taxpayers to provide their security for things that they own. I don't think the government should, for example, secure privately owned cell phone systems. Those are private, and the companies that own them should be responsible for their security. They're important, though.
Well,
that's what I think. I'm not talking about the idea that government should get out of the business of.
So, do you think our ports, for example, should be privatized? That
Pardon?
Our ports should be private. Do you think that our ports should be privately owned?
Ports?
Yeah. I'm talking about serious infrastructure here. Okay. I want to get back to this original point because we only have a minute left here. And you said countries create
what my paper is about. You're really
and you're setting me right. I appreciate that. Countries create governments mainly to protect society against threats, foreign and domestic. The preamble of the Constitution says, "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty." That doesn't say it's primarily to protect us against threats, foreign and domestic. It seems to me that we create governments to help elevate all of us up to the highest possible goals that we can achieve in life.
That's the That's a mission statement for the U.S. government. My statement in context is about governments in general. That's a function that all governments.
But who says? Who says?
That security is a fundamental governmental role? That's the U.S.
No, you say that that's the main reason why governments are created.
Yes, that is the main reason why governments in general are created. I wasn't talking about the U.S. government.
Yeah, Eli, you feel like I'm misinterpreting what you're saying. You want to stick around for a couple of minutes and let's dig a little deeper into this?
Sure.
Okay, great. We're talking with Eli Lehrer of Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org is the website. 16 minutes past the hour. Got to take a break here.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
And Ron was the whiz bang on the dial. Almost as big as Jesus.
Oh, it's the Enron song. I love this song.
They had to catch your name. And they put it on the baseball park downtown. Enron took my money. We lost it all, they say. With questionable accounting, I gutted my 401k. I became a pauper and a pawn in a couple of days. When the New York Times said the stock is dead, now the trial's begun. They'll be taking the fifth block, Kenneth Lee.
Yes. The Enron song. I got hosed by Enron. Hey, by the way, go over to airamerica.com to the Tom Hartman page. There's a link there to tomhartman.com, our website, and also on the airamerica.com site. And once you get to our Tom Hartman page, click on my name there, you'll find our daily blog, and you can post your thoughts for the day about our show, the news, all things relevant, and David Poole will be picking his favorite blog entry for the day at the end of the show, and we will send that person a copy of my new book, Screw the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and what we can do about it. We're talking with Eli Lehrer. He's the senior fellow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. CEI.org is their website, and the co-author, along with Wayne Cruz, of a new study, The Flexibility Solution, How Private Enterprise Can Improve Infrastructure Security. And Eli, the three main points that you make in this study are limits to government's role, government rigidity versus private flexibility, and then, well, actually, I'd say four, and then new strategies for airline and electrical grid security. First of all, am I accurately characterizing your report?
Yes.
At that point. Okay. And where I'm challenging you, and I'm really not just trying to score points or play gotcha here, I really want our listeners to understand the core philosophical disagreement that you and I have on this, is that you're suggesting that the only role of government is to protect society against threats, foreign and domestic. And I'm suggesting that, or at least the primary,
yeah.
You say governments, countries create governments mainly. And I'm suggesting that the primary reason why countries create governments is not that. I'm suggesting that the primary reason that people collectively form governments is the same reason that we form families. That governments are simply an extension of the instinct of family and clan. And that is that we create governments in order to protect all of us collectively, not to protect us from predators outside, but to catapult us into the future, to lift us up, to allow each person to achieve its highest potential. That's what families do, and that's what government does.
I don't necessarily disagree with your idea that is a proper role of government. I was simply making a general point about something that all governments have in common. I think the focus on security is something that all governments have in common.
Then why would we give that to private corporations? I mean, why would we
to give it over entirely to private corporations. I think in some cases, particularly for infrastructure security, it makes sense to have a larger private role because the private sector is more flexible as a whole.
But But the private sector is answering to one thing, the profit motive. The public sector is answering to one thing, the public good. How can you say that an organization whose primary goal is to make a profit, and they just happen to be making a profit by providing security, for example, for our airports, which they did a marvelous job of with their $7.25 an hour screeners on for example, September 11th, 2001, that these private for-profit corporations that are paying less than McDonald's, that they're going to do a better job of providing security for us when the profit motive is their primary goal than the TSA, who has one single job, period, provide security for our airports?
Well, first, I don't necessarily oppose the existence of some government role in this. The way the private sector handled airport security prior to 9/11 was not very good. But when TSA has been compared to private contractors,
that's because the government didn't handle it.
It's done no better or worse than them. The more fires.
Well, I haven't seen us attack since 9/11.
The more fires that exist, the more flexibility that there is. That's
why?
My point. Government
why?
Might be one player among many, and there's no reason why the private sector only has a profit motive, or the government only has the public good in mind. This is
there's a Supreme Court precedent
that I don't accept.
Well, the Supreme Court has ruled that if a corporation fails, if the management of a corporation fails to put shareholder value ahead of everything else, they have failed in their fiduciary responsibilities and
they're
criminally negligent.
That's a profit-making corporation. There are plenty of other types of corporate structures, some of which may be perfect for security.
But
not every corporation has exactly the same function. And in any case,
so are you saying that the profit motive
economy that really doesn't make any sense? And in addition, if government was doing so much better than the private sector at these things, then there'd be a point. When it comes to building an aircraft carrier, I sort of doubt the private sector could do it very well. When it comes to airport security, the evidence so far is that neither the government nor the private sector is very good at it. I think we should have more players involved, which might include local governments, local airport authorities. If they want to get in, great. That's
okay,
more flexible.
People can read all about it over at CEI.org. Eli Lehrer, thanks for being with us. Good talking
Thank you.
With you. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour. Hey, by the way, the Tom Hartman Program now has a comment line. If you don't want to just, talk with us on the air, but you'd like your thoughts to be heard, or if you can't get through, give us a call at 503-323-6620. It's an answering machine, basically, and you can voice your opinion on the Tom Hartman Program comment line. Please limit your comment to no more than 30 seconds, and remember that we may use your voice or opinion on the air. So the Tom Hartman Program comment line, call in and voice your opinions at 503-323-6620. And, of course, our toll-free number, 866-303-2270. We're going to get to that in just a second. We've got this is a quote from John Murtha, Jack Murtha, the congressman from Pennsylvania, the House Defense Appropriations Subcommittee chairman. We've got 126,000 contractors over there in Iraq, some of them making more than the Secretary of Defense. How in the hell do you justify that? American taxpayers have so far handed a staggering $4 billion to armed security companies in Iraq, such as Blackwater, which then showed up in New Orleans. Is this a good thing? I don't think that this is a good thing. I'll just put it right out. I just don't think that this is a good thing, period. And that we should be privatizing our security. I think that any time you've got people running around with guns that are not on private property, that are on public property, that they should be under the control of we the people collectively. People who are providing security services. If they're on public property, they need to be answerable to public authorities who are answerable to us. It just boils down to being that simple. 1-866-303-2270. Robin in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, Robin, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I just want to say the same thing. People who believe in privatizing government functions have a mistaken, idealistic view of how it would work. But Halliburton and other corporations where our federal government has been the customer has given us the reality of how they work. They get no-bid contracts from the government to do its functions, and then they milk the government through padded invoices and don't fulfill their contractual obligations. They did it in Iraq. They did it here. They'll do it here with our even with our education system and everything. And you multiply it exponentially with other privatization schemes, the country could go bankrupt. And suing the private corporations for not fulfilling their contractual obligations would just get tied up in courts for decades.
Yeah, this is exactly right, Robin. And this is what we're illustrating here is the cancer stage of capitalism. It's the point where because the Reagan administration and then the Bush senior administration and then the Clinton administration and then now the George W. Bush administration in the biggest way have lifted the regulations, the controls on corporate behavior in general, to the point that they are able to behave in ways that are completely, you know, the eggplant that ate Chicago, completely monopolistic, that we have the corporate power had reached out for control of government itself, and now we have this revolving door, this cronyism, this corporate government relationship that is unhealthy, and it's just absolutely destructive. Thank you very much, Robin. I appreciate the call, and thanks for listening on 1380 there in Baton Rouge. Ebe in Mississippi. Hey, Ebe, what's up?
Yes, I was listening to the program yesterday, the news, and was discussing that Michael Chertoff, help me with his name.
Chertoff.
He has a gut feeling that something's going to happen soon this summer before 9/11. And I wanted to get your opinion on that or your take on that. I'll give you mine right away. Mine is if something's going to happen with his gut feeling that to scare everybody up. So when this vote or whatever is supposed to take place to withdraw the troops, then everybody be so scared until they won't want to do it. Will you please give me your opinion on it, sir?
Sure. I think you're right, Ebe. And I think that this if you go back to the run up to the last election, up to the 2004 election. The government kept flipping up these terror alerts. Every time John Kerry got a little traction in the polls, suddenly there'd be a terror alert. And after the fact, the guy who was the director of Homeland Security went on the David Letterman show and said, oh, you know, I don't know why I did that. I mean, I was told to do that by Karl Rove in his office. It was purely political. Our government, our federal functions, our federal security functions were being manipulated for partisan gain running up to the 2004 election. And the head of the Department of Homeland Security said so on national television in a couple of venues. That, in my opinion, is a crime. And I think that that's what Michael Chertoff is doing right now. He's trying to consume the news cycle. I mean, you've got all this stuff, this terrible stuff going on, terrible from the point of view of the administration, and including this vote, as you point out. And that's what I think he's doing. Thanks for calling in, Ebe. And in fact, here it is. The vote just happened, or actually, the vote just didn't happen. The Republicans have filibustered, and you know, maybe the Democrats should just say, okay, keep the filibuster going. Maybe they need to change the rules of filibusters. Senate Republicans have succeeded in filibustering Jim Webb's Senate Bill 2012, which would have said that. Our troops are required to have home downtime between combat tours that is appropriate. You know, the classic traditional amount of home downtime between tours. Stop breaking our Army and our Marine Corps, in other words. And the vote was 56-41 to end debate. Now, you know, what this means in the Senate, you can debate something to death, literally. You just keep talking and talking and talking and talking and talking, and you never get around to have a vote. And you have to end the debate before you can have a vote. And it takes 60 votes. There's 100 people in the Senate. It takes 60 votes. That's more than half to end debate. And there's only 49 Democratic senators. And you got Tim Johnson, who's still recovering from his, you know, kind of semi-stroke thing, whatever it was called. So they were able to get some Republicans in on this thing. Norm Coleman, Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins, John Sununu, Chuck Hagel, Gordon Smith, and John Warner. All of them except Olympia Snowe up for re-election next year. Those Republicans voted to end the debate. But it wasn't enough. The vote was 56-41. And I don't have the actual breakdown right here. I'm sure somebody in the chat room will get it for me. I'm guessing that probably Joe Lieberman did not vote to end debate. By and large, he's not voting with the Democrats on this. Good old Joe. And so 56-41, we're still four votes shy of ending the debate so that an actual vote can be held. This was a bill to support our troops. And the Republicans are saying no. We're not going to allow the Democrats to have a vote on this. I mean, this is absolutely bizarre. Absolutely bizarre. Earl in San Jose, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Earl, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Referring back to Mr. Eli, my experience, maybe your experience, every experience is different. I've worked for Unisys twice, government contracts, as a prime contractor with the DOE out in Idaho at a national nuclear lab up there, something called the Idaho National Engineering Laboratory in Idaho Falls. And the monitors, and I work for the Army as a civilian at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, for them, for you. And I don't want to single out any corporation, but just tell you all that, you know, the government in this case is the monitor on, or the short leash on the prime contractors. And I don't think Mr. Eli and some of his folks need to go out into the real world and get a little more experience and realize that there's mil-spec, there's standards working for. It's not like the Postal Service or over the Ronald Reagan aspect is of life. It's not. It's really not that one-dimensional. And I think their one-dimensionality has run down the accountability, the monitoring situation, how we can, you know, our government is run by the people, supposedly. So it's our theory. Their theory runs contrary to that, and it's obvious. And that's where the twain does not meet.
This is where it all began, Earl. This is where it all began.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government, and I'm here to help.
And everybody thought, isn't that cute? That's Ronald Reagan being kind of grandfatherly and making a joke. But it was part of a very, very, very destructive thought virus, a very destructive meme, which is that we, the people, should not be creating a government to protect us and a government to support us, frankly, to help us. That instead that you know, all of that should be handed over to private for-profit corporations answerable only to the profit motive.
Well, and finally, Tom, and you know, I can take this offline. You did, and this is not a bump on you at all, but you did have the guy in the line. Simply put, all you could have said is, Eli, we've outsourced the grand experiment with your friends Wolfowitz and Company and Pearl, the whole Iraqi mission, including Blackwater, the guy that wrote the book about Blackwater. Read that book, and it'll curl your hair. Eli, I mean...
And that's the point. And what are we going to do? You know, as Chris Hedges writes, you know, and this is where I got this quote from John Murthy. Chris Hedges wrote for the Philadelphia Inquirer a piece called "What If Our Mercenaries Turn on Us?" I mean, if you have private corporations that are running all of our security, you got private corporations running around with guns and things, and they're out in public areas protecting public infrastructure, and they decide to dance to a different tune. What are you going to do? I mean, it's at what point do we say no? No, wait a minute. We didn't mean that. We didn't mean that. Earl, thanks a lot for the call. We, you know, American taxpayers, $4 billion that we've handed over to private corporations just to provide security in Iraq. I mean, we've already privatized security in Iraq to a large extent. Are we going to privatize it here in the United States? This is crazy. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire.
Yes. This could be Senator David Vitter's song, I think. He visited the Canal Street brothel several times, beginning in the mid-1990s, paying $300 per hour for services. Attempting to defend him against the solicitation of prostitution charges, the so-called Canal Street madam, whose operation was shut down by federal investigators in 2001, said, "I want his wife to know he's a good man." And when Louise read that, she handed it to me. She says, "Huh, I wonder what he's good at." But here's the issue. I mean, this is the strangeness of this. First of all, there's the issue we talked about yesterday, David Vitter and his hypocrisy. He said during the Clinton impeachment, quote, "Some current polls may suggest that people are turned off by the whole Clinton mess and don't care because the stock market is good, the Clinton spin machine is even better, or other reasons. But that doesn't answer the question whether President Clinton should be impeached and removed from office because he is morally unfit to govern. The writings of the founding fathers are very instructive on this issue. They are not cast in terms of political effectiveness at all, but in terms of right and wrong moral fitness." And then he goes on to quote Alexander Hamilton in Federalist Number 65. He said, "Impeachable offenses are those that proceed from the misconduct of public men or, in other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust." So he thought having sex with an intern was that. Frankly, I think that George W. Bush has abused the public trust far more than Bill Clinton ever did, number one. And number two, what I find particularly interesting is that Bill Clinton having sex with a consenting adult, Monica Lewinsky was 22, 23 at the time, however old she was, having sex with a consenting adult, was not a crime. At least I don't believe that in Washington, D.C. it would have been a state crime. It would have been a state law. But most of those laws against extramarital affairs or whatever have been taken off the books in every state across the country. So as far as I know, Bill Clinton did not commit a crime. But Vitter, paying for sex, did commit a crime. Now, it's something that I'll tell you right up front. I don't think should be a crime, but it is a crime. And where are the Republicans going, "Hey, wait a minute, this was a crime that Vitter did. It's not just immorality, it was he participated in a criminal activity." And it gets weirder. Baby, indeed, the rich get richer. Seafaring super rich dive to ocean bottom in luxury submarines. The luxury submarine business is sometimes hard to fathom. This is from Bloomberg. "If you could find my submarine, it's yours," says Russian oil billionaire Roman Abramovich, and that's all the reclusive owner of the Chelsea Football Club has to say. The ocean floor is the final spending frontier for the world's richest people. And Jean-Claude Carme, vice president of marketing for U.S. Submarines, Inc., he says, everyone down there is a wealthy eccentric. They're all intensely secretive. Estimated 100 luxury subs are roaming the oceans right now. Who owns them? A mystery. Too bad I can't afford a submarine for my floating home here on the river in Oregon. But there's something I can't afford. This is something I could do, and this is done by an Oregonian here. This guy out of Bend, Oregon. Last week, Ken Couch settled down in his lawn chair with some snacks and a parachute. Attached to his lawn chair were 105 large helium balloons. Destination, Idaho. With instruments to measure his altitude and speed, a global positioning system device in his pocket, and about four plastic bags holding 19 liters of water each to act as ballast, he could turn a spigot, release water, and rise. With that, Couch headed into the Oregon sky. Nearly 9 hours later, the 47-year-old gas station owner came back to Earth in a farmer's field near Union, Oregon, short of Idaho, but 310 kilometers from home. Cool. He says, "When you're laying on the grass in the summer day and you see the clouds, you wish you could jump on them." So this is as close as you can come to jumping on them. It's just like that. Yeah. Helium balloons and a lawn chair. I can't do a submarine, but I could do helium balloons and a lawn chair. Anyhow, 1-866-303-2270. Charlie in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Charlie, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. You know, when you talk about the privatization, the more you think about it, the more you see the guys in Abu Ghraib, you know, these contractors, the number of contractors. And then think about, they've tried basically every area of our lives. They have education, charter schools. They tried to sell the ports. There's no security at chemical plants.
They did sell our ports.
They did. That's right. Other parts of the infrastructure, selling parts of highways.
Indiana selling off, leasing the Indiana toll road.
Yeah, healthcare.
And it's one of many.
The prescription drug plan, prisons, our elections. They have the private companies won't give the source codes. They even
That's right. 80% of our votes now are being handled by private corporations, and many states have outsourced to private corporations handling who the voter rolls are, you know, who gets to vote and who doesn't get to vote. The IRS has been outsourcing this stuff, and it turns out that one of the companies, you know, collecting data on taxpayers, and it turns out that one of the companies that was doing it was also, for some reason we don't understand, collecting information not just on your tax information, but on whether or not you were registered as a Democrat or a Republican.
Student loans have been turned over to collection agencies. Our national parks, mineral rights, oil leases, the way they get faith-based organizations now to handle drug treatment, everything's privatized. And look at the results of it. Getting the Heritage Foundation to staff Iraq, the whole country there where they banned unions, when they instituted the Davis-Bacon Act after Katrina in New Orleans, it turns into disasters because they're incompetent most of the time. What really gets me, if you think about it, they'd like to privatize information. They have the Fox News Channel as the government organ. Jeff Gannon, you know, they have their own. Cheney won't give the names of his employees. The archives go to investigate him. He says abolish the department. It's everything's privatized. To them, this government is like a private industry to them to make money off and run it into the ground and then move on.
Yeah, very well said, Charlie. And that's the thing. I mean, they keep saying, oh, do you want the government doing this for you? Don't you want a choice in it? Well, you know, if I don't have a choice when the monopolistic corporation comes in and says, well, okay. I mean, it's like every time you go to the doctor, the health insurance company says, okay, you've got to call us five times before we'll decide to pay this bill. That's some kind of choice. I'm sorry. You know, Social Security writes checks very well, thank you very much. Medicare writes checks very well, thank you very much. There's a lot of things government can do well. 57 minutes past the hour.
Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. This is what I want to share with you here is both a local issue for us, those of us who live here in Oregon, and a national issue. And frankly, I think the national issue part of it is the most important part of it. But for those of you who don't live in Oregon, just a little perspective. In the 2002 election, freshman Senator Gordon Smith, a Republican from Oregon, was up for re-election. And an ad ran all across the state of Oregon that, well, here's the ad.
Some say you can't fight the federal government.
They should meet Gordon Smith.
Gordon went to bat for our farms and our jobs.
Water's our problem and bureaucrats.
He took it straight to Bush.
He got Democrats and Republicans involved.
Senator Smith won emergency funding.
He wouldn't take no for an answer.
That's Gordon.
He stood up for us.
Independent, effective, Oregon's Gordon Smith.
Gordon Smith carried our water.
And that click, click, click sound, is what you're viewing is the spraying of water by irrigation systems. And this was such an effective tool for Gordon Smith. Gordon Smith won his re-election, and this was such an effective tool that it got taken to a step beyond this. And TJ, who is the co-founder of the liberal political blog journal Loaded Oregon, O-R-Y-G-U-N, loadedoregon.blogspot.com is the website, is with us. Hey, TJ, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you, Tom? Thanks for having me.
Just great. Glad to have you with us. TJ, this spot, at the time, everybody thought, well, okay, Gordon Smith has jiggered things around. First of all, let's just make it clear to everybody what happened here. Where did the water come from that all these farmers were saying, hey, Gordon Smith got us our water?
Came from the Klamath River Basin, and what they had to do was to release the gates that were holding it back for the fish in order to get it all the way down to the irrigation points that needed it in the lower Klamath Basin.
So and what was the consequence?
I'm sorry?
And the consequence of that was what?
Was that we had the largest adult salmon fish kill in recorded Western history.
In the history of the United States?
In the history of the West, yeah.
In the history of the West, yeah, of the Western
77,
states.
77,000 salmon.
Yeah, 77,000 salmon. And this, by the way, I remember last year doing the local program here. There was a moratorium on fishing. I mean, the fishing industry just got wiped out.
Right. It's still continuing. It's been devastated. If there are three things we get from this entire segment, the first one is that while you read about Dick Cheney's involvement in the fish kill from the Washington Post, and you read about Karl Rove's involvement from the Wall Street Journal, you have to understand that Gordon Smith wasn't just Rove's intended beneficiary. It said in the, that Rove was trying to get Smith reelected, and that's true. But Smith himself was deeply involved. He was in the loop, and we think there's evidence that he may have even instigated the entire thing by writing a letter to the White House in early 2001. But the second thing is, if it's natural and newsworthy for us to scrutinize members of Congress like Pete Domenici and Doc Hastings for their roles, putting electoral politics before the rule of law at the Department of Justice over the U.S. Attorney scandal, then surely it's got to be worthwhile and newsworthy to scrutinize Gordon Smith for his role in putting electoral politics before the rule of law at the Department of Interior. And if the regular media won't do it, then it's up to – you don't have to sit there and take it. As a citizen journalist, like I consider myself, you can get the information yourself or seek it out and at least educate yourself and maybe people that you know.
Yeah, and you've done a really great job investigating this story. We're talking with TJ. He's the co-founder of the liberal political journal Loaded Oregon, oryguen.blogspot.com. And TJ, Karl Rove then took this success where they had a federal agency actually intervened in the flow of water in this state that led to a massive salmon kill, but it helped out a bunch of farmers who were major donors to Smith's campaign, and it allowed him to run ads like he was a big friend of agriculture, particularly in those parts of the state where agriculture has a lot of money and a lot of power in this state, and it got him reelected in 2002. Karl Rove took this on the road as a PowerPoint presentation to show how Republican politicians, because Republicans controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House, Republican politicians could manipulate government in order to get other Republican politicians elected or reelected.
Right, and he did that apparently at Gordon Smith's behest. On March 30th in 2001, Gordon Smith wrote a letter to the White House and said, quote, "I respectfully request that your domestic policy team become involved in the issue." Well, Karl Rove is the head of the domestic policy team, and you have to ask yourself, why is a domestic policy team being involved in an issue that is entirely decidable on science? The Endangered Species Act is very clear. You decide what happens based on the best available science in order to protect the endangered species. What does that have to do with Karl Rove? Nothing.
So how did Gordon Smith and Karl Rove get the Department of the Interior?
Yes, the Department of the
How did they get the Department of the Interior to break their own rules and say, out of hell with the fish?
Well, what they did was basically an end-around on the science. Instead of asking the question, what is the best way to protect the suckerfish and the coho salmon in the Klamath Basin, they changed the question. They said, well, is it totally provable that keeping the river water levels high will save the fish? And what they said was, well, these water flow measurement studies you're using, they haven't really been peer-reviewed. Now, I'm not sure that anybody really peer-reviews what essentially is a technical manual. I think Poor Richard's Almanac, you would measure the tides. This guy was measuring, it's called the Hardy Phase 2 report, but basically it's strategic measurements of flow levels that allowed the federal biologists to determine, what needed to be done or what the best thing to do was to protect the fish. Well, what Karl Rove and Dick Cheney, at the behest of Gordon Smith, had them do was to ask a different question. Was, well, can you prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that this will protect the fish, or that if we don't do it, it will kill the fish? And because they were able to remove the best available science out of the equation, then they were able to say, no, you really can't prove it, and therefore there's no reason for us to keep the river waters high.
Yeah, this brings to mind yesterday's testimony by the second Surgeon General in the United States, who was working for the Bush administration before Congress, saying that his office was politicized. And when he tried to talk about the realities of stem cell research, he was told to sit down and shut up, essentially.
Surprised me was that it seems as if Gordon Smith knew exactly what was going on. If you read the Washington Post series about Dick Cheney, they spent a lot of time in the Klamath portion of it talking about Cheney working behind the scenes. But apparently he was telling Gordon Smith what he was going to do, because in the Washington Post article, an aide to Cheney says he remembers the vice president asking, isn't there some way around this law, this Endangered Species Act? And in an article in the Klamath Herald around the same time, Gordon Smith was talking to farmers, and he told them Dick Cheney, quote, ordered the biologists back to Washington to see if there was some way to get around it, the conclusion. So he knew exactly what they were going to do, and he knew that they were going to challenge the science by claiming that it wasn't peer-reviewed. He tried to have twice bills inserted into the congressional record to prevent any consideration of studies that were not fully peer-reviewed. So he knew what they were doing.
Are there any other examples around the country, TJ? We're talking to TJ at Loaded Oregon, O-R-Y-G-U-N dot blogspot.com, a blogger here in Oregon who has been really doing great research on this. Any other examples of places where the office of the vice president and or Karl Rove have actually intervened in local politics in on behalf of local Republican politicians, in this case the state United States Senator, to get them reelected and bent or broken rules? I would submit to you that David DeGlacy, that the whole U.S. attorney scandal is an example of that. And this is an example of that. Are there others that you know of, TJ?
I think the U.S. attorney scandal is a perfect corollary. It's really the broader picture of the White House using electoral politics as a wedge against whatever the expected way is for things to happen. You know, in the Department of Justice, the U.S. attorneys were supposed to be basically insulated from political pressure. Well, the same thing is true when you talk about the Endangered Species Act. The scientists who make the determinations based on the best available science are supposed to be insulated from the politics that would, you know, change that decision, and that's not what happened. And you mentioned David Iglesias. This issue has its own whistleblower. His name is Michael Kelly, and he's a federal biologist with the Fish and Wildlife Service, or excuse me, National Marine Fisheries. And he said, "This, I'm being told to change our conclusions. We're being told to do what is politically expedient." And he was like David Iglesias. He was, you know, shouted down and marginalized, and basically, told he was nuts.
Yeah, this is grim. TJ, blogging over at Loaded Oregon, loadedoregun.blogspot.com. You can read all about it over there.
To Bush.
He got Democrat.
Yeah, he got to Bush. That's the ad. TJ, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Well, I'm going fishing in the morning, gotta catch the early light.
No, you're not.
I'm going fishing for a feeling, I give them the fish bite.
I don't think so.
Oh, I gotta say my prayers, roll down the covers, kiss my wife goodnight.
Now you got to kiss Gordon Smith. Actually, maybe instead of kissing him, kicking his butt or something. Because there ain't no more fish. Because Gordon Smith done killed him. Oh, man. Speaking of politics, Al Franken. God bless him. He's raised nearly $2 million in the latest reporting period. More money than Senator Norm Coleman, one of the running scared, up for re-election Republicans in the Senate. Who he is, Al Franken is going to be running against. Al Franken, the guy who, on many of the stations that are carrying this program, preceded me, and preceded me here on Air America Radio in this time slot, and or I guess the proper way to say it is for whom this show took over. We replaced Al Franken on the Air America Radio network, and very proud to do so. Al is a great guy, and here's the amazing thing about Al Franken's campaign. 95% of his contributions, he raised almost $2 million in Minnesota. 95% of his contributions were less than $100, $100 or less. That's good retail politics. That is absolutely great. And speaking, by the way, of Minnesota, this is incredible. One of the, we have radio stations. We're on radio stations all over the country, if there's a product that I think is good and a local advertiser would like me to voice their spots, I'm pleased to do it. And I did one for Mad Woman Foods Bake Shop and Foodery on Nicollet Avenue in Minneapolis, because we're on the air in Minneapolis, and they just, I have celiac disease, so I can't eat anything that has gluten in it. And Madwoman Foods makes the, I got to tell you, it's madwomanfoods.com. For those of you who share my condition, Keith Olbermann has this condition as well, by the way. Isn't that interesting? Anyhow, those of you who can't eat gluten, their food is incredible. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. It is the best gluten-free food I've ever come across in my life. And I just got a note from them saying, thanks for helping us out with the radio ads. Every day we get people in the bake shop that say, Tom Hartman sent me. We really appreciate your support. So I want to thank you and no, that was not a paid commercial announcement. It's just, I think it's great that our advertisers are getting results. That's what Progressive Talk Radio is all about. Alberto Gonzalez knew of violations. Two of his aides, two senior Justice Department officials, on a telephone call arranged by press officials at the Justice Department, said yesterday that they kept Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez apprised of FBI violations of civil liberties and privacy safeguards prior to the time that he said before Congress there has not been one verified case of civil liberties abuse after 2001. Alberto Gonzalez, caught in the act, caught red-handed. Now, this was in 2005 that he was testifying before the Senate, and this was a time when the Senate was controlled by the Republicans, the House was controlled by the Republicans, the White House was controlled by the Republicans, and so Gonzalez at that time believed, and I'm sure that, you know, with the ongoing quality of the caging operations that are still going on, by the way, around the country, denying people the right to vote, and all the other scummy things that the Republicans have been doing around the country to diminish the ability of people to vote. I'm sure he thought that the Republicans were going to continue to hold power so he could lie before Congress and nobody would ever investigate it. I mean, let us not forget Paul Weyrich, the architect of the so-called Reagan Revolution. And one of the, and he's, this guy's been consulting Republican politicians from the 1970s until today. He was also a consultant to the Bush campaign. Paul Weyrich speaking before a group of Republican operatives in a church talking about, well, you know, I'll let you draw your own conclusions.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And therefore, let's pass laws making it harder and harder for people to vote, making it, having them jump through more and more hoops, provide more and more ID, let's do caging lists, let's send out letters to them to see if they've moved. If they don't respond to the letter, well, let's challenge them, let's have them vote on placebo ballots, called provisional ballots, and on and on and on. So I'm sure Gonzo thought that he would never be investigated, and he could therefore lie with impunity before Congress. And in my opinion, the Republicans stole between 4 and 5 million votes in the 2004 election, and it just wasn't enough because we turned out 5 or 6 million more people than they expected. And frankly, I think that there's at least 20 House seats and 2 or 3 Senate seats that probably should have gone Democratic if it wasn't for caging and vote rigging not enough machines or not enough ballots in this area and all the little tricks that the Republicans play. But nonetheless, Gonzo's been caught. And now the question is he going to be prosecuted? Is he going to be prosecuted? And he's the head of the Justice Department. So without a special prosecutor, he would have to prosecute himself. Something that I don't think is going to happen. So then the question becomes, will a special prosecutor be appointed? That's something worth calling your Congress, member of Congress about, 202-225-3121 for your member of the House or the Senate. 27 minutes past the hour. I want to talk about economics when we come back.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Going down a river, leaves me feeling good inside. Going down. Yesterday, slowly fade, I've been waiting now forever for its ride.
some interesting gigs coming up this weekend. This Saturday, Seattle's Progressive Talk, AM 1090, is bringing six national talk show hosts to Seattle Town Hall for July 14th for an AM 1090 forum, Perfect Presidents or Perfect Politicians. It's a one-night event with special guests Stephanie Miller, Ed Schultz, the Young Turks, Mike Malloy, and me. I'll be the moderator. The tickets are already sold out, but you can watch the live webcast of the event, whether you live in Seattle or anywhere else in the world, on am1090seattle.com. am1090seattle.com. I'll also be in Grand Rapids, Michigan, for a special live broadcast and book signing Friday, July 20th at the Celebration Cinema North. Looking forward to meeting you, and for information, you can go to... we'll actually be doing the show live from a booth that's in the shopping mall there, you know, the theater, and you can walk in and say hi, and we'll be right on the air there. And I'll also be doing a talk and a book signing at Schuller's Bookstore in Grand Rapids that night at 7 p.m. You get more information on that over at WTKG.com, WTKG.com, our Grand Rapids affiliate. And the following Monday, I'll also be doing our show live from our Detroit affiliate, WDTW, in Detroit, although that's not going to be so much of a public event, more just, you know, I'll be there using their studios. Yesterday, the Wall Street Journal reported, this is an article by Serena Ng and Ruth Simon, the headline, Ratings Cuts by S&P Moody's Rattles Investors. And again, I think a lot of people are going, ratings cuts, rattle, you know, rate, what, Moody's, why should I care? Well, I'm telling you, this is going to hit home big and fast. Here's the first paragraph of this article. The widening meltdown in the subprime mortgage market caught up with the nation's two big debt rating companies yesterday, with Standard & Poor's and Moody's. These are the companies that determine the value, the rating of debt instruments, bonds. So if a company wants to borrow money, they have to issue a bond, just like the U.S. government. If it wants to borrow money, it sells treasuries. So it's they rate, by the way, U.S. Debt instruments as well as corporate debt instruments. And when their ratings go down, then people have to offer higher rates of interest in order to get people to buy those bonds. So anyhow, Standard & Poor's and Moody's announced plans to downgrade hundreds of bonds backed by the risky home loans. This freaked out the market. And in fact, Aiden Forecast is a newsletter that I subscribe to, a financial newsletter, and their monthly summary came out yesterday. And they did, AidenForecast.com is their website, and they just do some really great research, these folks. And a couple of the points that they made that I think are really worth repeating is that over the past 10 years, housing prices have soared more than in any period since 1890. Consider that for a minute. Last quarter, home prices dropped for the first time in 16 years in 20 metropolitan areas. The debt, the mortgage debt, that in the last 6 years was created by this cheap credit, free credit, we'll loan money to anybody kind of policy that was encouraged by the Fed. The debt, the mortgage debt created over the last 6 years is equal to the mortgage debt created during the entire previous 50 years. Are you starting to get the proportions of this? Literally trillions of dollars, thousands of billions of dollars were lent to people who really probably shouldn't have been borrowing that money, who didn't really have the credit to do that, to buy homes. And so the consequence of this is that foreclosures right now are 90% higher than they were a year ago. And this is just the beginning of it. The Aiden Forecast notes $1 trillion in adjustable rate mortgages will be reset over the next year or two. In other words, as interest rates go up, these arms are going to go up. Bottom line, by the way, let me add on that, is if you have an adjustable rate mortgage, get into a fixed rate mortgage as fast as you can. That, to the extent that, or let me, you know, this is not a financial advice show, and I'm not a financial advisor. Let me just say, if I had an adjustable rate mortgage right now, I would pay just about any rate to get into a fixed rate mortgage right now, because I think that a year from now, 2 years from now, we're going to look back on the cost of fixed rate mortgages right now, and we're going to say, boy, were those low. Because what we're seeing is a repeat of the 1970s. And I bought a house back in the late 1970s and paid, as I recall, 14.5% or 15%, might have even been 16%, on a home mortgage. And that was, you know, with good credit. That's just what it was. Inventory of homes right now higher than it has been in the last 15 years. The ratio between home supply and demand, the worst in 35 years. Again, this from the Aiden forecast. So talking about, you know, the what's happening now is the banks are starting to pull back because you know, the money has been made. The brokers took their commissions. These loans got bundled into these basically instruments that could be sold and traded on the open market. And they're starting to lose their value, because people are walking away from these homes. And we're not talking about, you know, fly-by-night operations here. The biggest subprime lender in the country is Wells Fargo Bank, Goldman Sachs, Citicorp, Morgan Stanley, big in the subprime market. And this is starting to make a lot of people a little spooked. You know, is this are we going to see the 1970s again? Now, at the same time, people say, well, does that mean that there's going to be a stock market crash? I don't know. I don't think so, actually, because the stock market is increasingly reflecting the interests of transnational and global corporations rather than the interests of average Main Street businesses in the United States. So while the average medium and small business may be going in the tank, and the average person in America may be going in the tank, big transnational and global corporations are probably doing just fine, thank you very much, and not going in the tank. So I'm not sure about the stock. You know, it's, I don't know. But I do know that there is, my guess is that what we're looking at is significantly higher interest rates down the road and a spooky time in the housing market. Meanwhile, China has reported a record high trade deficit with the United States, trade surplus with the United States. This from today's Financial Times. China's swelling monthly trade surplus hit a new high in June of $26.9 billion, an 85% increase over the same month last year. They have a chart on the page here, and it goes to 2002, 2003, 2004. The line is kind of flat at about 20%, the trade balance. And then, boom, it explodes up through 50, 100, 150, 200, all the way almost up to $250 billion over 04, 05, 06, 07, the Bush years. The surplus for the first half of the year has now reached $113 billion, more than for the whole of 2005, and equal to about 8% of China's expected economic output for the first 6 months of this year. 8% of the entire Chinese economy is showing up in our stores. And China has 1 billion people. We only have 300 million people, so they've got more than about four times as many. They've got 1.2 billion. They've got about four times as many people in China as we do. And 8% of their entire output is showing up in our stores. That would be like, you know, 30, if you were to multiply that by 4, 8, 16, 32, that could be like 32% of the American workforce. I mean, if I'm doing my math right, if we were making that stuff here instead of there. And so what do we do about it? Well, you know, there was a bunch of U.S. politicians are saying, well, we need to realign the currency. China has to raise the value of their currency. That'll make imports into the United States more expensive. Well, it'll also make China richer, by the way, and China is slowly moving in that direction. But there's a lot of pushback on this now. There was this piece of legislation that has been introduced by Max Baucus, Chuck Grassley, Chuck Schumer, and Lindsey Graham. It's bipartisan. And they wrote a piece, actually, in the Financial Times on July 6th that was called We Must Act When Currencies Become Misaligned. And Michael Wolfuck, the senior currency strategist with the Bank of New York Mellon, wrote a letter to the editor of the Financial Times in today's issue of the Financial Times. He says, sirs, U.S. Senator Max Baucus, Chuck Grassley, Chuck Schumer, and Lindsey Graham argue in favor of requiring the U.S. Treasury Department to identify misaligned currencies. He says, first of all, it's unlikely to be diplomatically viable. Second, it's unlikely to achieve its desired aim. And then he points out one of the unintended consequences. And see, I don't think this was unintended at all. of pursuing an aggressive globalization policy is that wealthy countries such as the U.S. must largely sacrifice their manufacturing sector. This has been true in Europe and Japan, and it's certainly true of the U.S. Yes, sir. But I don't think it was unintended. And then you got a whole bunch of economists here, the global head of currency strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman, the senior currency strategist at Brown Brothers, the currency strategist at IDEA in New York City, the Royal Bank of Canada, the fixed income analyst, a market strategist in Toronto. They all signed this group letter to the Financial Times saying that the U.S. Senator's defense of their bill that seeks to shift the Treasury Department's currency market oversight away from declaring manipulation and towards identifying misalignment will likely fail. Yeah. What we need to do is do away with these insane trade policies and stop trying to say, oh, it's just about the value of the money. It's not about the value of the money. It's about what we're importing and exporting.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Let me just boil this back down into plain English just for a minute. And then we're going to pick up a conversation with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. But first, we used to have trade policies in the United States where we basically said we're going to allow companies, including transnational, multinational, international companies, to move products and services and money around. But in a regulated fashion, we're going to do it in a way that's going to protect American jobs, it's going to protect American industries. And we stopped doing that because we stopped doing that starting with Reagan and big time during the Clinton administration because we said, oh, well, you know, we should just let the big corporations run the world. They know best. Let the free market decide. We used to regulate banks. Used to make it, you know, very hard for people who didn't have good credit to get a loan because we saw what happened in the 1920s. When people who didn't have good credit could get loans to buy stock. And the stock market crashed. And we stopped regulating banks because we said, oh, well, you know, well, actually, because the banks took a lot of money to Washington, D.C. and said, stop regulating us. And now nobody's willing to even talk about going back to those processes and policies that actually built this country and protected us from the implosions that are built into unregulated laissez-faire capitalism. That's the bottom line. And so they're all pointing fingers and trying to pretend it's something that it's not. Oh, it's just because the Chinese are keeping their currency cheap. It's not. And even the leading economists in the world are calling them out on it now. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's Ellen is traveling with the president, or is she back?
She's back, yes, indeed. She wants to be back because today is the opening of the new James S. Brady briefing room.
Oh, my goodness.
This is a very big deal for us. This is huge.
Okay. Tell me about it.
Well, the James S. Brady briefing room was completely renovated. We've been in exile for 11 months. We were told when we were exiled across the street that it was going to be redone and we'd be brought back. We didn't believe it. And astonishingly, the president opened it at 8:05 this morning with Mrs. Bush and cut a ribbon. And this was a promise of his administration, which he kept.
Amazing. Amazing. And this, of course, is where you guys from the press talk to folks like Tony Snow.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
So having talked with Tony Snow and whatnot, what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now?
Well, there's an awful lot of talk about the war. There's talk about the war. There's also some talk about what Chertoff said yesterday about his gut feeling. That was the question that I asked about today. His gut feeling about terrorist attacks, also about the senior intelligence officials telling ABC that Al-Qaeda cells are coming over here or are already here. But a lot of concern about the way the White House seems to be spinning the Republican defections on the war and their seeming inability to get on the same page with everybody else as to what actually is going on over there.
But at the same time, there was an attempt today to bring a piece of legislation forward that would simply require the troops to have a break between combat missions that is the traditional break, I believe, that the military has always offered soldiers during time of combat.
That's
and the Republicans in the Senate filibustered this, and so they were all, they could get 54 votes to stop debate and actually have a vote, which means that this legislation probably would have passed. I mean, you know, there's a vote of 50 or 51 will pass the bill. But it takes 60 votes to stop the debate so that they can have the vote, which takes 50 votes, which seems very weird, I think, probably to a lot of people, but that's the way the Senate works. And so the Republicans are filibustering this when the Democrats would even think about filibustering something like Sam Alito's nomination, for example. The Republicans would hold press conferences. It would be the top story in all the news stories. Chris Matthews would talk about it for an entire hour. There would be, you know, churches all over America having meetings. Why are the Democrats not absolutely raising hell about this Republican filibuster?
Because they're lame and pathetic.
Oh.
That's the answer. Because they should be. Because they're spread too thin. They're talking about the war. They've got the hearing with Sarah Taylor on the attorneys general. They've got the habeas corpus thing going on with Leahy and Spector.
And yeah, they should be able to walk and chew gum at the same time.
Well, you'd think that they could, but they apparently can't. And that's one of the problems they're going to have next year, you know, in 2008, if indeed they manage to get anybody past the primary and into a general election in terms of trying to get anybody elected. They apparently cannot. They are not organized enough to start having press conferences on something which is clearly something that the public would be incredibly sympathetic with. It wasn't even as if they were asking for much. I think it was simply parity, a year over there for a year at home.
Right. Yeah, or 6 months there, 6 months home, you know, whatever it may be. Yeah, and
right.
And this was from, you know, Jim Webb was putting this thing forward. The guy used to be the Secretary of the Navy. He's a veteran, a combat vet. Bush has broken our Army and Marine Corps, and Webb was saying, here's a simple way to at least soften the damage. Now the effect of this obviously would have been if we have to start giving our soldiers the breaks that they actually deserve. Then Bush would either have to institute the draft or he'd have to draw down the troop levels because he wouldn't have enough troops. And so this was sort of a backdoor way of forcing Bush into unsurging his surge. And that's really what this was all about, right?
Right. That's what this is all about. And he's not going to unsurge the surge. He's just going to surge forward, as we know. I mean, there is going to be no change on that. It was made very clear yesterday in Ohio in his speech where I think some people very optimistically and unrealistically, I think, thought that he might be announcing some kind of change of policy. The man doesn't know the meaning of the words change of policy.
Yeah. So we're up to 54 votes now in the Senate. Do you think that there are, I mean, there are 13, as I recall, 13 Republican senators up for re-election. Five of them just voted with the Democrats on this issue. Are the other eight going to come along?
I think you may get another three or four. I don't know that you're going to get all eight yet.
Well, they need six.
Take time.
They need six more to block, you know, to invoke cloture. Do you think that the six are going to come down the road?
I don't think they're going to get six yet. No.
So we're just going to, it's just going to be then at that point, then the Democrats really need to be raising hell about this lack of a filibuster or this effective filibuster, their inability to overcome a filibuster.
Yes,
Victoria Jones. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, Sarah Taylor, the Justice Department, the White House political aide, Karl Rove's office, Bush's office, Cheney's office, she was testifying today before Congress. And White House political director is her official title. She's testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee about her involvement in the firing of nine U.S. attorneys last year. And there were a lot of things that she simply refused to talk about. She said, well, you know, the president said I can't talk about that, and he's asserting executive privilege, blah, blah, blah. But she also obviously got the Alberto Gonzalez School of How to Testify training. which is where they teach you, this is the exact same training that Ronald Reagan got during the Iran-Contra hearings, which is where they say, you know, if you say no and it's a lie, or if you say yes and it's a lie, you can be prosecuted for perjury. And if you tell the truth and it was a crime, you can be prosecuted for the crime. But if you say, I don't remember, it's not a crime to have a bad memory. Now, a lot of us cut Reagan a pass on his 100 and some odd times saying, I don't remember, figuring, well, okay, it's early Alzheimer's. But Sarah Taylor, I don't think so.
How do you account for Mr. McNulty? How do you account for Mr. McNulty having a different conclusion, if you can account for it, that Mr. Cummings was removed or asked to resign to make room for Mr. Griffin?
Yeah. Again, I don't know all the conversations that took place with Mr. Cummings, and I don't know sort of the entire timeline.
Did you or Carl Rove ever request that Department of Justice officials remove Mr. Biskupic from his position as a U.S. attorney?
I don't know.
She's ready
Did you
for that
or
one.
Carl Rove ever discuss Mr. Biskupic's performance with Kyle Sampson or other Department of Justice officials?
I did not ever discuss it. At least I remember.
That I don't remember. I don't believe I did. And it goes on like that over and over and over again. There's a compilation of it over at thinkprogress.org. In her testimony, they note Taylor is demonstrating a memory worthy of Alberto Gonzalez, who said, I have no recollection, I have no memory, or I don't recall 64 times while testifying. She didn't quite hit his record, but she's doing well. Kyle Sampson, 122 times, didn't remember. Bizarre. Absolutely bizarre. And sometimes, you know, obviously Sarah Taylor doesn't know what she doesn't know, or she does know, but she's not willing to tell. Sometimes you and I know what we know. We don't, or there's things that we don't know that we don't know, things that you don't know that you do know that you don't know that, well, there's the knowns and the unknowns and the unknown knowns. And then sometimes, of course, everything you know is just wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
The Olmecs. David Childress is with us. He's an archaeologist and explorer. AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com, the website. He has a new book out called The Mystery of the Olmecs. Some folks refer to David as the real life Indiana Jones. David, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's good to be on with you, Tom.
Great to have you here, David. Olmecs. I don't think a lot of people have even heard that word.
You know, more and more people will be hearing about the Olmecs. The Olmecs are the oldest civilization in the Americas now, older than the Mayans. And in fact, now everything that the Mayans were credited with inventing originally, such as the Mayan number system, the hieroglyphic writing system, even the rubber balls and the ball game they played, even their early cities, is now all ascribed to these other, even stranger people, known as the Olmecs.
This is, in other words, the Olmecs are the older civilization. And the Olmecs are from what we call Mexico, right?
Well, that's right. Today they're ascribing the area of southern Mexico on both coasts, the Atlantic and the Pacific coast, as the land of the Olmecs, which they call Olmen. And what is so strange about the Olmecs is that they look very different from the Mayans. The Mayans look traditionally like, as we expect, Native Americans to look. Native Americans basically do not have facial hair. They cannot grow really a thick mustache or a beard. But the Olmecs would have that. And in fact, what most people think of when they think of the Olmecs are these giant, colossal heads, they call them. And these heads were discovered in the late 30s and early 1940s by the oil exploration in the swamps of Tabasco in Mexico, and they just dug up these giant heads. But they...
You're talking statuary.
Statuary, yeah. And these 20-ton... heads, I mean, they're missing the body, they just have the head, but when you look at these guys, And this is what we generally think of the Olmecs. They don't look like American Indians. They look like African rugby players. I mean, these guys look extremely...
So in your book, you're suggesting or implying or coming right out and saying that the Olmec territory was really a trade route between Africa, Asia, and Europe?
Yes,
back 1,000 years ago or more?
That's right, 3,000 years ago, in effect.
3,000 years ago.
The Olmec started around 1,300 B.C. or so. They lasted around 1,000 years and then mysteriously disappeared. We don't know why exactly. But the Olmecs, yes, were this very much like America today. They were this mixture of different races. Many Olmecs looked very African, extremely so. Other Olmecs, well, looked different than that. They looked very Chinese. Well, even a third type of Olmec looks like some Phoenician guy. He's wearing a turban. He's got a thick beard and a thick mustache. And he doesn't look African, but more like some European guy. So it's like the land of the Olmecs was this transoceanic center where ships were arriving from the Pacific. They were arriving across the Atlantic. They were coming literally from ancient Egypt. Ancient Phoenicia.
Yeah, you've got a bunch of pictures in your book of Egyptian statuary and Olmec statuary that are identical. It's a fascinating hypothesis, and it raises another issue, which is a lot of people get all hysterical about this whole immigration issue about people from Mexico or from Central America and South America coming into the United States, but these people were occupying this continent for what, 10,000, 20,000 years?
Well, right. It's a mystery, particularly of the population of the Americas. Traditional historians, archaeologists are telling us that all Native Americans 10,000 years ago or 15,000 years ago walked across the Bering Land Bridge. They had to walk all the way down through Canada, eventually getting down into southern Mexico. From there, they continued walking all the way to South America and became the Indians.
And you're suggesting that wasn't the case, that these were seagoing expeditions
as
well.
No, that's right. The idea that people had to walk everywhere, that's, I would say, unscientific, although that's what they're teaching in universities all over America. Oceans aren't barriers. Oceans are highways. I mean, the easy way to go somewhere is not to walk through hostile tribes, for years, but to actually get in a boat and go somewhere. And that's exactly how the Olmecs arrived.
Did you find evidence beyond the fact that it appears to be a multiracial society? Did you find evidence of the actual boats or the sea lanes or navigation or anything like that down in Mexico?
Well, you know what? I mean, yeah. Finding the boats, finding the port cities,
or finding a stone that has a compass or a map of the world carved onto it, or something like that.
That kind of a thing. Actually, in 1995, an expert from Beijing in China, who was an expert on the earliest Chinese hieroglyphs, which are the Shang Chinese oracle bone hieroglyphs, and this is the very beginning of Chinese writing. He went to Mexico City to look at early Olmec writing on jade statues, and what he declared at the time was that early Olmec writing was identical to the early Shang Chinese writing.
It was just 3,000 years ago.
That's right. And the Shang China is the earliest of all the Chinese dynasties.
Fascinating stuff. David Childress, the archaeologist and explorer, his new book, The Mystery of the Olmecs, the website adventuresunlimitedpress.com. David, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thank you.
Good talking with you. This is fascinating stuff. And equally fascinating, talk about impenetrable mysteries, Sarah Taylor testifying before Congress. The great Bush cover-up rolling along. We'll get back to that right after this, 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
I'm just trying to be a father, raise a daughter and a son, be a lover to their mother, everything to everyone. Up and at 'em bright and early, I'm all business in my suit. Yeah, I'm dressed up for success, from my head down to my boots. I don't do it for the money, there's bills that I can't pay. I don't do it for the glory, I just do it anyway. Providing for our futures, my responsibility. Yeah, I'm real good under pressure, being all that I can be. I can't call in sick on Mondays when the weekend's been too strong. I just work straight through the holidays, sometimes all night long. You can bet that I stand ready when the wolf growls at the door. Hey, I'm solid, hey, I'm steady, hey, I'm true down to the core. And I will always do my duty, no matter what the price. I've counted up the cost, I know the sacrifice. Oh, and I don't want to die for you, but if dying's asking me, I'll bear that cross with honor, cause freedom don't come free. I'm an American soldier.
Indeed, and we need to support our American soldiers. Jim Webb today tried to do so. Jim Webb introduced into the United States Senate a piece of legislation. This is absolutely mind-boggling. Jim Webb introduced into the United States Senate a piece of legislation that simply said that our soldiers should get a break between tours of combat equal to the time that they were in combat. I mean, this is not rocket science. This is very straightforward stuff. And the Republicans in the United States Senate said, no, we're not going to let the Senate vote on this. There were enough votes to pass this piece of legislation. They had 54 votes for this thing. It only takes 50 votes to pass a piece of legislation in the Senate right now. Even to defeat Cheney trying to break a tie, because you've got, you know, there's only 99 senators who are able to vote right now because Tim Johnson can't be there. So it only takes 50 votes to pass a piece of legislation in the Senate. But it takes 60 votes to say to a Republican senator, shut up and sit down. The debate is over. We're going to discuss this. The Republicans filibustered this thing. Larry Scott's with us with VAWatchdog.org. VAWatchdog.org, one of the very finest of the veteran sites out there, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Tom.
I've been raving. We were just hearing Toby Keith's song about our soldiers, and then, you know, my rant about Jim Webb in the Senate, and this is just disgraceful. It's absolutely disgraceful. But
yep.
It's a reflection of the way that this administration and Jim Nicholson, the VA secretary, have been treating our veterans from day one.
That's absolutely true, Tom. The veterans have been getting a shaft from this administration for over 6 years now, and we've talked about Jim Nicholson before. His only qualification to become Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, the man who was in charge of the health care and the benefits of millions of veterans, was the fact that he was the chairman of the Republican National Committee. To say that this person is nothing but a political hack is the politest thing I can say. And veterans...
Well, it's an insult to political hacks.
Beg your pardon?
It's an insult to political hacks.
I apologize.
So anyhow, Larry, we only have a minute or two. Okay. What are the top stories on VAWatchdog.org today?
Well, an interesting thing, and this goes to the politics of what we're talking about here too, Tom, and that is the House Committee on Veterans Affairs held a special hearing in New Orleans on Monday. As you may or may not know, the VA hospital in New Orleans has been closed down since Katrina, and they haven't even decided on if they're going to rebuild it. This is just a terrible story. Veterans in that area, there are a few clinics in the area that are open, but veterans are having to be shipped all over the South to receive any type of regular or specialized medical care. And the politicians on Capitol Hill still can't decide. Representative Jeff Miller, a Florida Republican, says, now why do we want to rebuild it here? I need it in Florida. Why don't you give me the money? We've got more veterans over there. So we've got all of this political infighting. And the veterans are saying, just stop the talking and build the hospital. We need the hospital here. But we get into this politics of, Well, because the population in New Orleans has gone down, that means there are fewer veterans, so do we need to build the hospital? Of course, the real argument here is, if we do rebuild not only services like the VA, but if we rebuild businesses and we put money into this community, we know the people are going to come back, and New Orleans will once again become a strong, vibrant, viable city. So they're arguing and saying, well, we don't even
know. There's a subtext here, Larry, and I think that that's that if they rebuild it, then the African-Americans are going to be coming back. And that's I would not discount the racist element in this whole thing.
You know, well, of course, that's not going to come out in a House committee hearing. Nobody's going to come out and say that, obviously, Tom. But we do get the subtext of, well, there aren't as many veterans here now, so maybe we shouldn't even build the hospital. We're going to keep an eye on this.
Is this partisan, Larry, or is this just screw-up?
Yes, it is.
It is partisan?
Yes.
And so it's the Republicans who are blocking the construction of the new VA hospital?
They're not blocking it. They're just saying, let's kind of look elsewhere.
Yeah. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org. You can check it out. Larry, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And then they hear the people cry, but still ignore the human rights. Fighting for land and isle, don't care whether you live or die. War up so, war down so, war over so. Everywhere is war, political war. We're singing war up so, war over so.
The war seems to be everywhere. I'm going to Michael Ware weighing in on CNN. We'll get to that in just a second. First of all, welcome back. Thank you for listening to the program. Listener-supported radio here, the Tom Hartman Program, supported by you, our listeners, supporting the program and Progressive Talk Radio by supporting our sponsors. Listen for local sponsors that you can support. Let them know you're listening. And also our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com. Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com. The Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE. Purina One, 1-866-380-MEOW. Okay, here's the deal. Michael Ware, the CNN Baghdad correspondent, and I believe he was formerly, and perhaps currently still is, with Time Magazine. I think they're both owned by Warner, is it? In any case, it's by Time Warner, yeah. In any case, Michael Ware was being interviewed by Anderson Cooper last night. And here's Anderson Cooper first plays for Michael Ware a clip of Joe Lieberman on the floor of the Senate and then asks Michael Ware what he thinks about it. This is classic.
Michael, I want to play something that Senator Lieberman said about the war in Iraq. Listen.
The war is not lost in Iraq. In fact, now American and Iraqi security forces are winning. The enemy is on the run in Iraq. But here in Congress, in Washington, we seem to be, or some members seem to be on the run, chased, I fear, by public opinion polls.
Is
the enemy? I mean, this is incredible. I'm sorry, Joe, there are a bunch of enemies, as Michael Ware then pointed out. So Anderson Cooper then turns to Michael Ware and says, you know, is this true?
The enemy on the run in Iraq, Michael?
No, certainly not. And I think we need to be aware that it's enemies. I mean, America doesn't face just one opponent in this country, but a whole multitude, many of whom are becoming stronger the longer the U.S. occupation here or presence here in Iraq continues. So unfortunately, I'm afraid that Senator Lieberman has taken an excursion into fantasy.
An excursion into fantasy, yes. When the reporters are saying, I mean, yesterday was Jim Webb. He says, I don't know where Lieberman gets his opinions. Well, now we know. Fantasy. That's a plan. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mark in Vermont. Hey, Mark, what's up?
How are you this afternoon?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
You've been better? I heard a comment about the Clinton impeachment, and kind of struck a chord. As you're aware, he wasn't impeached for improprieties in office with regard to an intern, but he was impeached for the same thing that Scooter Libby was tried. That would be lying to a grand jury and obstructing justice.
Yeah, actually, it wasn't even a grand jury. It's really important to stop right there. He lied in a civil lawsuit.
Okay.
It was not a grand jury. And he ultimately was not... And yes, he was under oath.
Okay, so
but it was not before a grand jury.
Oh, okay. Fortunately for him, he was tried by a jury of his peers. That would be the snout-stuffing Congress that can't cast up a buck to line their pockets. And if he had been tried, if Scooter had been tried by a bunch of crooked lawyers as he is, he probably would have gotten off, too.
Yeah, well, I think Scooter did get off too, and that's the problem. and the fact of the matter is that this is the main right wing talking point. Scooter Libby was charged with the same thing Bill Clinton which was lying. That's not what Scooter Libby was charged with. Lying before a grand jury was one of the counts that he was charged and convicted of, but the bigger one, which Bill Clinton was not prosecuted for, was obstruction of justice. There was an attempt to stop an investigation into who outed a CIA agent's identity and brought down an entire CIA operation that was helping protect this country. And instead, whoever outed this put our CIA officers at risk all around the world. There was an attempt to find out who was responsible for that, who was behind that, who did that. And Scooter Libby was, to quote Patrick Fitzgerald, threw sand in the umpire's eyes. That's what he was prosecuted for. And that's, in my mind, it's just a whole completely different thing. Chris in Santa Fe, California?
No.
Santa Fe, New Mexico. Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Not much. I question on the attorney gate, whatever you want to call it. You mentioned that Sarah Taylor today in front of Congress claimed executive privilege, or she was constrained by executive privilege. Right. Now, the White House has been very, very adamant for months now. Tony Snow said it, Alberto Gonzalez has said it, even George Bush has said it, that the president had nothing to do with the attorney firings. He wasn't involved at all. That raises the question. Obviously, if he wasn't involved, then Monica Goodling and Harriet Myers and Sarah Taylor weren't advising him on it. So where does executive privilege come in? He cannot claim privilege for conversations he wasn't involved in.
Well, and this is the thing that I think this testimony is revealing, and I haven't had an opportunity yet since she started testifying about the same time I went on the air, but I intend to look it over. My guess is that if you look at those areas where she says, I can't talk about that because of executive privilege, those would be the areas that give the lie to the assertion by the Bush White House that Bush had nothing to do with or was unaware of or not in the loop or the White House was not part of those decisions to fire some of those attorneys. And frankly, the larger question that, damn it, the Democrats need to be answering, which is not just why did these nine guys get fired, nine men and women get fired, but why did the other U.S. attorneys keep their jobs?
Well,
what were they doing right
yeah.
that this administration wanted done that shouldn't have been being done?
Well, that's absolutely true, but I'm saying that executive privilege, in this case anyway, seems to be a tacit admission by the administration that Bush was involved in it. Otherwise, he can't claim privilege.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, Chris. And we'll see how this thing plays out. Thanks for the pointing that out. Leah in Tampa. Hey, Leah.
Hi there. I want to just say something to the fellow that just called about comparing Bill Clinton to Scooter Libby. There is no comparison. None. Bill Clinton was indicted by the House of Representatives, and that's called impeachment. Then he goes to the Senate, and he's tried. And he was found innocent by the Senate.
That's
he was never convicted of anything, nothing. So when people say, oh, well, Scooter Libby was convicted for the same thing Bill Clinton was, Bill Clinton wasn't convicted of anything.
I know. This is the right-wing talking point. I mean,
the American people
pure and
need
simple.
To understand that impeachment doesn't mean conviction. It means indictment. And I don't know why they can't get it. I learned that in the seventh grade.
Well,
so
they don't teach that
really
in seventh grade
me
anymore.
It really annoys me every time I hear it. So that's all
Leah,
I have to say.
Leah, I'm guessing you were in the seventh grade before 1990.
Yes, I was.
because they don't teach that in the seventh grade anymore. This is an important issue. During the 1980s, during the Reagan administration, there were purges of our public schools and our textbooks. And it was, you know, the same stuff that David Horowitz is doing in our colleges right now. They were doing, and many of us who are old enough remember it well, they were doing in the high schools, saying, you know, these textbooks are, you know, they're talking about Mother Jones and Joe Hill and all these communist union organizers back in the 1880s and the union teachers, and they're all communists. And there was this huge purge, and we basically don't teach civics much anymore. We just, you know, they just have to memorize a few dates and, you know, what year was the Constitution ratified? What year was it? You know, and that's it. You know, the people today, kids are graduating from high school without any fundamental understanding of civics because of this purge during the Reagan era.
Well, and I've had kids graduate through high school. I had three kids that went to school in Michigan, and the last one graduated in 1994, and all learned civics. I don't know how they managed to do it. I don't know if I taught it to them or they got it in school or what, but they all know what it all means.
Yeah, well, that's good.
And they follow everything very closely, and I'm really proud of them for that.
Yep, that's good, and good on you, Leah, for doing it. Yep, you're welcome. But I'm telling you, it ain't happening now, at least not the way it should be. Vince in Northern California listening on the Quake. Hey, Vince.
Hey, Tom, nice to speak with you. Hey, I'm just wondering, where are, you know, all the Democrats that should be calling up and down vote? Where are they? Let's just give it an up or down vote.
And this is my point to Victoria.
Look, even when the Democrats didn't control the Congress or the Senate, I know in the Senate they had 40 senators. They should have been able to block two recent Supreme Court appointments.
They should have been able to. And you know, I asked Victoria Jones, you know, why don't they? And she says, because they're lame. And you know, to give them, you know, to cut them a little slack, it's not really because they're lame. It's because, you know, the old joke of I'm not a member of an organized party, I'm a Democrat, is true.
Yeah.
You know. And that's frankly, you know, it was funny for Will Rogers to say it, but it's appealing to many of us, frankly, the fact that the Democratic Party doesn't operate like the Nazi Party, it doesn't operate like the Communist Politburo, and it doesn't operate like the Republican Party. It operates like a big tent where a lot of people have a lot of different voices, and the consequence of that is that it's more small-D Democratic, but that means that it's not the lean, mean fighting machine of a semi-fascistic organization or a crime family. It's not operated like the mafia, you know, like the Republican Party is. And then, it's a tough one, because on the one hand you want to say, damn it, get your act together, and on the other hand you want to say, isn't it wonderful that you guys are all fighting with each other about stuff, because that's how democracy is supposed to work, you know. So I don't know, Vince. Thanks a lot for the call and for bringing it up, but it makes us all crazy. I mean, it's the truly wonderful thing about the Democratic Party, that they have a broad spectrum of voices and they actually let people have their say. And it's the truly weak thing about them. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number. Tim in Portland, Oregon on the line, listening on KPOJ, our home station. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I've been on hold for a while, and I originally wanted to talk about the possibility of reinvestigating 9/11. Is it all right if I make a comment on that?
Sure.
Yeah, I guess my concern as just an average Joe American is that, you know, you're going to have to do the research for yourself. I think there's plenty of things out there. 911truth.org is just one website, and I think that there's more than enough weird coincidences, shall we say, and and unanswered questions that, I would love us to reinvestigate what happened that day. I think we have a right to know, and if national security is such an important issue, I would think that everybody would be behind that.
Tim, I absolutely agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. And in fact, we've been talking with the folks over at 911truth.org about, as I said, I mentioned this a week or two ago, putting together a show. The challenge that we have right now is finding somebody who will defend the government's position, and we're still working on it. And if anybody out there wants to do that, let us know. Send an email to david@tomhartman.com. You'll find the link over at tomhartman.com for David's complete email address. Beverly in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Beverly, what's up? Beverly?
Oh, here I am. Sorry.
You are on the air. There you
I
are.
Have
no, you're here.
In front of me, a book by Dave Lindorf, an investigative journalist, and Barbara Olshansky called The Case for Impeachment.
Yes.
And Olshansky is actually a lawyer, international and national. And it's a very convincing case. There have been a number of other books of this type. And, of course, we're familiar with John Conyers' original indictment of Bush. And, of course, Cheney, what's his name, our senator from Ohio, Kucinich, has been pushing that. And I don't think it's impossible. It's a matter of strategizing because the votes are not really there. We know that. But I want to raise the question of why this has not come up. There's been a lot of corruption, not just Abramoff and the Halliburton ties to Cheney, but all kinds of things. And
we have violated international laws by extraordinary rendition and torture. We have broken down habeas corpus, something that goes back to 1215. The violations of the Presidential Records Act by the the using the RNC servers for emails and then not keeping those records when they explicitly knew it. They wiretapped us without warrants. It was illegal. Arguably, you could say parts of the Patriot Act.
This list of indictments against King George. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. The caging votes line us into a war. I mean, it's incredible.
So why can't we push that? I don't blame the Democrats. I think the Democrats are struggling for good strategizing. And they really, they're doing their best. I wouldn't criticize them. But
well, that's my point. It's
what?
That's my point, is that their strength is their weakness and vice versa. And frankly, I wouldn't want it to change. And it should be the way our nation is. Our nation should have a little bit of paralysis once in a while we discuss things and we
like to talk about politics. I'm considered a real maverick and a gecko or whatever. I don't know what the word is. Gadfly. Yeah. And I was a social studies teacher as well as an anthropologist. So I just can't help it. To me, it's part of me. History is.
Yeah. Yeah. It needs to be for all of us, Beverly. You made your point very eloquently, and I appreciate it. And it is an issue that needs to be on the table, in my opinion. We need to put impeachment back on the table. Captain Zeppelin in California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Captain.
Hey, what's up? The lame duck isn't the president. The lame duck has got to be Nancy Pelosi. She is powerless, and I think everybody should get behind Cindy Sheehan's march. If this march took place back in the 60s, there would be thousands of people behind her. But, I mean, a year ago, everybody was screaming.
But back in the 60s, Captain, there would have been thousands of kids in our... There were thousands of kids in the California public school system, in the California college system, who had absolutely no debt, who were able to go to school for free. They weren't worried that if they don't show up, or if their name shows up on the wrong list, or if they get their credit gets busted, they've lost their education.
They had to go to school for free, or they would ask would have been drafted to Vietnam. That's
well, there's that. There's that. But I don't think the majority of people who were in college in the 60s were there to avoid the draft. We didn't see a sudden drop in college admissions after the Vietnam War ended.
My word is just to get behind Cindy Sheehan and impeachment. And if Pelosi doesn't do anything, get her ass out of there.
Yeah,
she's grinning like an idiot while she's giving body counts. She's got to go in for a tune-up and have her last facelift dialed down a little bit. She's looking
come on. I'm not going to go with all this personal nonsense. But the fact of the matter is that she does need to be hearing from her constituents. And all of us, frankly, are her constituents. And, about what we think should be happening and how it should go. Norman Long Beach, we just have a couple of seconds left, Norman.
Hi, yeah, before I get to the impending thing about Cheney's impeachment. The Democrats will never get to the Rose Garden if they keep getting led down the garden path. You can't judge others by yourself.
Yeah. Well, this is, the Democrats need to be standing up, and they need to be saying, hey, wait a minute, the Republicans in the Senate here, they just filibustered this piece of legislation that Jim Webb put forward that would have protected our troops, that would have supported our troops. The Republicans are filibustering legislation that would support our troops. And the Democrats, that they should have made that the major talking point, said forcing essentially all of the corporate, the handmaiden media out there to be saying, oh, this is the big story of the day. You know, let's create a gang of 14 around this. Coming up tomorrow, Mark Crispin Miller, Christy Harvey, Laura Wallach. It's going to be Matt Renner. It's going to be a fascinating day. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.